I want to start by asking a question. What is true Christianity? What is true Christianity? What does it mean to live the Christian life? Some Christians will say that true Christianity is about knowing truth, knowing the truth about what Christ has done for us in dying for us and saving us by his death on the cross. Others will say true Christianity, living the Christian life, is about how we respond to that. It's about obedience. It's about godliness. It's about holiness. And others will say true Christianity is about caring for the poor, getting out into the world and getting our hands dirty, making a difference in our society. So what is true Christianity? Well, you won't be surprised to hear me say that, yes, that is true Christianity. Yes to all of them. Those are all what it means to be a Christian. And that's what 1 Timothy is all about, I think. Paul is writing to Timothy, who's gone to Ephesus to sort out the problem of false teachers. False teachers who are teaching heresy, false teaching, which is leading to false behavior, wrong behavior, ungodliness. And what's Paul's answer to this? Does he say to Timothy, well, don't worry about the teaching part, but just get them to live good lives, okay? That's the important thing. No, he doesn't say that, does he? He says to Timothy, teach sound doctrine. Teach sound doctrine, which will lead to godly behavior. So we saw that a couple of weeks ago in chapter 3. Have a look at chapter 3. That's verse 16. Beyond all question, the mystery from which true godliness springs is great. He appeared in the flesh, was vindicated by the Spirit, was seen by angels, was preached among the nations, was believed on in the world, was taken up in glory. That's the truth about Jesus Christ, who appeared in the flesh and died on the cross and rose to be with the Father. That's the mystery from which true godliness springs. The mystery, the truth, the wonderful truth from which true godliness springs. We see it in chapter 4 last Sunday. Have a look at chapter 4, verse 6. If you point these things out to the brothers and sisters, you will be a good minister of Christ Jesus, nourished on the truths of the faith and of the good teaching that you have followed. To be a good minister of Jesus Christ, he is to be nourished on the truths of the faith and of the good teaching. Truth and teaching nourish us. They feed us. So, good teaching leads to godliness. False teaching leads to ungodliness. And so you may say, we're good on teaching here at Kensington. We have a lot of that. But let's just do a bit less of that and focus a bit more on living good lives. Paul would say to you, you're right to be focusing on living good lives, but we don't teach less, do we? Or maybe you're someone who loves the teaching and will go home after the Sunday service and will mull over the teaching, but then that won't actually change your life. And Paul would say to you, true doctrine must lead to godliness. And now in chapter 5, this is our passage, Paul writes that true Christianity includes caring for our needy. True Christianity includes caring for our needy. And we'll look at it under three headings. First, exhort everyone as family. Second, the church cares for those who have no family. And third, families care for their own. So first, exhort everyone as family. And the first couple of verses in chapter 5 are link verses, following on from chapter 4. So have a look at chapter 4, verse 12. Don't let anyone look down on you because you are young, but set an example for the believers in speech, conduct, love, faith, purity. Talking about the false, possibly about the false teachers, possibly some older men, and saying to Timothy, be strong, don't let these older men look down on you. be strong. But then moving on to chapter 5, he's moved on from talking about the false teachers and now talking about the whole congregation. And what does he say? Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat your younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, with absolute purity. These verses speak for themselves, don't they? Timothy might be more educated, gifted than the older men, but he's not to lord it over them, but he's to exhort them as he would his father, lovingly, gently. Now, none of us are like Timothy, exactly. Timothy wasn't a pastor, an elder, a deacon, a ministry leader, a home group leader. Timothy was Paul's number two guy, who he sent into churches to sort out problems. And none of us is a Timothy. But many of us are in similar positions to Timothy. Young men in some position of responsibility in the church. And this speaks to us, doesn't it? And I found these verses particularly challenging for me as I've looked at these over the past few weeks. Am I treating men who are older than me with love and respect? If I disagree with them, am I doing so lovingly? Or am I, contrary to chapter 3, for instance, am I being quarrelsome, violent, as young men are often prone to do? But more than that, there's a broad principle here for all of us. We are a family. We are a family. We saw that a couple of weeks ago. Chapter 3, 14 to 15. Although I hope to come to you soon, I'm writing to you with these instructions so that if I'm delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household. The church is God's household. We are family. Take a look around you now and look at your brothers and sisters, your mothers and your fathers. Those who you get on better with, those who you get on not so well with, the ones who are slightly odd that you probably wouldn't have chosen to be part of your family. We are your family. And therefore we must treat each other as family. Brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. Lovingly, gently. And to men particularly, with absolute purity. We're to treat young women as sisters, aren't we? With absolute purity. This is a danger for us. In a congregation this size, there'll be women here who we may well be attracted to. Are we going to treat them as sisters? With absolute purity. So first, exhort everyone as family. Second, the church cares for those with no family. And Paul now spends the rest of our passage, verses 3 to 16, on one subject, the subject of widows. The headline is verse 3, give proper recognition to those widows who are really in need. Because in those days there was no welfare system, there was no pension. If your husband died, you could be in serious trouble. And that's why there was strong language in the Old Testament about taking care of widows. So have a look at these verses in Exodus chapter 22. God says, do not mistreat or oppress a foreigner, for you were foreigners in Egypt. Do not take advantage of the widow or the fatherless. If you do and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry. My anger will be aroused and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives will become widows and your children fatherless. Strong language. And this passage shows that the early church had a list of widows that they were supporting regularly. So, verse 9 in chapter 5. No widow may be put on the list of widows. Verse 11. As for younger widows, do not put them on such a list. But the problem seemed to be that these young widows who are on this list and therefore receiving regular financial help didn't have much to do. And they were going about from house to house gossiping idling. Look at verse 3. Besides, they get into the habit of being idle, going about from house to house. Not only do they become idlers, but busybodies who talk nonsense, saying things they ought not to. This was a time of arranged marriages when older men often married younger women, and people died younger than they do now, so young widows were quite common. And the church had limited resources, a limited pot of money to help those in need. So how would it prioritize that fund, that pot, to help people? Well, here's one principle. There are two principles here. Here's one principle. Verse 3, give proper recognition to those widows who are really in need. Really in need. Who have no one else to look after them. So look at verse 4. If a widow has children or grandchildren, these children or grandchildren should learn first of all to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family and so repaying their parents and grandparents. If a widow has family, the church doesn't need to care for them because they've got family. As for younger widows, they're young enough to get married again and they won't need support from the church as well. Second principle. The church is to care for those who've proven their godliness in the past by their actions. Look at verse 9. No widow may be put on the list of widows unless she's over 60, has been faithful to her husband, is well known for her good deeds, bringing up children, showing hospitality, washing the feet of the Lord's people, helping those in trouble, and devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds. So what about the widow who's 59 years old? She won't get any help, or the widow who hasn't had children and therefore hasn't been able to demonstrate that she has brought up children well. Well, I don't think that Paul is asking the church to be completely rigid here. The age of 60 signified that you are elderly, too old to get married, maybe too old to work for yourself and support yourself. You need to have demonstrated your godliness through a variety of good works. So this list showed a widow who was a godly, mature believer involved in the life of the church. These were the kinds of widows who the church could have a regular, ongoing financial commitment to. The church could be free to help anyone else who was in need. But these are the kinds of widows who they had to have a regular commitment to because they had no one else and because these guys were family members. So the principle is the church helps those who've got no one else to help them and who've proven their godliness by their good works. What about Kensington then? We don't have a widow's lists like this, although we've got about 35 widows in our church. There's a widows group which Chris mentioned that meets for encouragement and support. I think we can broaden this application out a bit. We've got a pastoral care fund. Do you know about this, the pastoral care fund? A pot of money which some people give to, and from which we help those who are in serious financial need. The pot is limited. So how do we decide who to give to? Well, 1 Timothy 5 helps, I think. Those who've got no one else to help them and who've proven their godliness by good works. This doesn't mean we never give money to anyone else, but it shows the priority where there are limited funds. The priority for mature, godly believers who've been involved in the life of the church and you've got no one else to help them. And other parts of the Bible back this up. Galatians 6, verse 10. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. Do good to all people, especially those who belong to the family of believers. We're to prioritize those who are our family, our fellow believers. But we provide volunteers at the Wild Goose every Sunday evening, and we serve food to those who, to anyone who comes along. They're not Christians. Should we stop doing that? Or what about the people who come to the door during the week and ask for food? They're not Christians. Should we stop doing that? No. We're free to help anyone. But the priority, where there are limited resources, Paul says, are our own family, our brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, our spiritual family, that is. Now, it might be helpful here to spell out the difference between church as institution here and church as organism. So, when you go out as an individual believer and you see someone on the street who would like some food and you buy them a sandwich from the local shop and you give them some food, you're helping someone as a member of the church. And we see the church as an organism, helping people in lots of different ways as individuals go out and get involved in a variety of different things. But the church also functions as an institution, as we organize a regular group of volunteers on a Sunday evening to help at Wild Goose. Or as we arrange to give money from the pastoral care fund to people in financial need. The church as an institution is more limited due to the limited number of staff we have and due to the limited pot of money that we have. The church as a body, as an organism, is less limited because you guys and we guys can go out into lots of different places and help each other where we see need. It's less limited in that way. The church as an institution might need to prioritize more with the pot of money that we have. The church as an institution may only be able to get involved in one mercy ministry. The church as an organism could be involved in 15 different mercy ministries, as, say, for example, Bex Rice gets involved in 125, helping women in street work, and she's involved in a project there. Or as Joe Firth gets involved in a variety of different community projects. Or Naomi Gill sleeps out on the street this Friday to raise money for crisis center ministries. Or Mike Phipps gets involved in the Barton Hill community, befriending people and aiming to share Christ with them. The church as organism can get involved in lots of different things. And maybe that's a helpful distinction here. So the church, functioning as an institution, prioritizes their help by helping those mature, godly believers who've got no one else to help them. So how do we, going back to widows and widowers here, how do we help widows and widowers in our church? How can you guys do that? Well, Chris has really honestly and helpfully shared what is helpful for her and what might be helpful for other widows and widows. Obviously, each individual is going to be different. I recently read a blog post by one pastor who said that one particular grouping in a church would be especially useful for widows and widowers. I don't know what you think about this, but young mums with small toddlers who are at home during the day and might have a bit of time with their toddlers to go and visit, say, a widow each week or each month, whatever's practical, that kind of thing. That was what was suggested on this blog post. How can you help our widows and widowers? Have you thought about giving into the pastoral care fund? Maybe increasing your monthly standing order by £10 or £20 a month and just telling Phil Hodges that extra bit, please can you put it into the pastoral care fund so that we can help more people in need, so that we don't have to prioritize as much and we can help more people. Before we finish, we need to tackle one last point which has been mentioned but not actually explained so far. Third, families care for their own. So have a look at verse 4. If a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn first of all to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family. And so repaying their parents and grandparents, for this is pleasing to God. The church is family, we're family, but that doesn't take away our normal family relationships as well. The word for putting religion into practice is to show godliness. This is godliness, caring for our parents, our frail parents. Not only our parents, but for all our relatives. And verse 8 shows that it's for all our relatives, but especially for our household, and maybe especially for our parents. Look at the strength of Paul's language. If they don't care for them, they've denied the faith and are worse than an unbeliever. If you don't care for your family, you've shown that you're not really a believer. You've put the Christian faith in a bad light. You're worse than an unbeliever because unbelievers care for their families. What's the principle here? Families are responsible for looking after their own, so the church can look after those who have no family. Are you doing that? Or are you assuming that the church will look after them? In our day, we're more likely to be assuming the government will look after them. We've paid our taxes, our parents get a bit old, and we put them in a care home. I'm aware this subject is complex and sensitive, but I do want to challenge us as a congregation on this. Is the default for our parents when they get frail, we put them in a care home? That's what everyone else does. The government's going to pay for it. Or do we care for them ourselves unless they need specialist nursing care and have to go in a home? It's difficult, isn't it? Are we repaying our parents and grandparents if we're not the ones caring for them? Let me gently challenge you in that area. And for those whose parents aren't at that stage yet, we need to get prepared for that. Because in 5-10 years, our parents will be frailer, and we'll need to be making those decisions. And we need to make those decisions now, before our parents get to that stage. And let me give a more general application here as well. Paul's got a very high view of families. In the whole letter, we've seen this in chapter 2, verse 15. Women will be saved through childbearing. Whatever that means, it's a high view of childbearing and raising family. Chapter 3, the qualifications for an elder and a deacon include being able to manage his own family, verses 5 and 12. And here in chapter 5, verses 14 to 15, Paul counsels younger widows to marry, have children, manage their homes. You see, the false teachers are forbidding people to marry. That's in chapter 4. Verse 3. And young women are going about from house to house, gossiping, idling, and some of them are getting mixed up with unbelieving men, and then getting married to unbelieving men. I think that's what verses 11 and 12 means, although it's quite difficult. The solution to this, Paul says, is to get married, have children, manage the home. Now, we're not in exactly the same situation as this. We haven't got these false teachers who are teaching these things. But we're living in a day and age where I think family isn't valued very highly. I think the statistics speak to that. We're getting married later on in life. The average age at which people got married in 2012 was 36 and a half years for men, 34 years for women. It's an increase by almost 8 years for both men and women since 1972. The fastest growing type of family in the UK is the cohabiting couple families, which grew by 29.7% between 2004 and 2014. Women are having kids later and later. They're encouraged to go back to work as soon as possible after having kids. Toddlers are sent to play school at an early age. Kids start school when they're very young. The working mum is the norm. And there'll be lots of different reasons for this, won't there? The need for two salaries to pay for a mortgage. A desire to keep our independence, maybe. The right person just hasn't come along. Infertility. And a host of other reasons. This is a complex and, again, a sensitive subject. But as a church, we need to be counter-cultural in our society. And we need to value marriage and family. How do we do that? Well, let me just suggest a few things. These could be talking points over tea and coffee afterwards. One way, help our single friends get married. Now, there'll be some of us squirming in their seats as I say that. But the alternative, says Paul, look at chapter 5. The alternative is some of our single men and women not finding a partner in church and going off outside church and getting married to a non-Christian and falling away from loving Jesus. And if that's the alternative, then we do need to be countercultural. And however much you squirm in your seats, I think this is something we've got to think about. Sensitively, gently, and some of us won't be cut out for doing these sensitive things. That's one possibility. As a church, we need to value families, encourage each other to spend as much time as a family as possible. And maybe this means not going back to work as early as possible after having a baby. Maybe it means not going back to work at all. I don't know. Maybe it means getting a slightly smaller house, cutting back on some expenses. This is difficult, isn't it? But we need to make wise decisions and godly decisions, and we need to help each other with these decisions in our home groups, be talking about these things, encouraging each other, challenging each other about these difficult decisions that we're making. Young mums and young women, are you using your time wisely? Different to how the young widows were using their time here. Now, Paul seems to suggest that a particular temptation for the young widows here was gossip, going from house to house, idling and busybodies talking nonsense. He's already spoken to men in particular at other points in the letter, and spoken to particularly male sins, I think. Chapter 3, I think, verse 3. The qualifications for an elder. Drunkenness. This is as in not given to drunkenness. Not violent, but gentle. Not quarrelsome. Not a lover of money. I think those are particularly male temptations. Or chapter 5, verse 2. Treating young women with absolute purity. Particularly male temptation. And here I think he's looking at a particularly female temptation. Not to say that us men won't gossip as well. Are you using your time wisely? Let me finish with a couple of words of comfort for us all. Maybe you love a family, but it just hasn't worked out. The good news is that families aren't ultimate. This family is ultimate. Your brothers and sisters here will be your brothers and sisters in the new creation for all eternity. Whereas our blood brothers and sisters, they'll be close to us in eternity, but there'll be no marriage in heaven. I'm sure we'll have a particularly close relationship with our spouse in heaven, but we'll be married to Christ. And so family isn't the ultimate thing. And one last thing, maybe you're thinking, My family's a mess. My family's a mess. What's the point? Do you know what the good news is? Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom we all are the worst. Christ's salvation covers everything. We don't approach God on the basis of how good our family is, but on the basis of what Jesus Christ has done for us in dying to take away our sins and make us right with God.